You've all met Phil Schiner this morning. For those of you who were not here, he likes to speak of himself as a practical lawyer with practical experience.
This afternoon I'd like to address the issue of how do we build a groundswell of public opinion. I'm quoting there from Miguel Marin Bosch in this book by Sarnes and de Chazanne on the ICJ opinion. It seems to me that what preceded the opinion in 1996 was indeed that groundswell of public opinion. And I want to suggest that apart from anything else, these international law arguments can be put in a different way and not just be confined to the court arena. Before making good that, I want to tell you what my view is and the view of others in the UK about how important international law has become post 9/11. I fail to understand why the US should be seeking to undermine the UN, because from where we sit, an analysis of what's happened since the events of 9/11 tell us in the UK that things are going incredibly well for the US and the UK. Let's just take one aspect. A few days after 9/11, on the 22nd of September, for the first time, the Security Council were persuaded to pass legislation. It was Resolution 1373, providing that all states should engage in a range of measures to combat terrorism. That trend has been followed on several occasions. If one looks at Resolution 1546, just before the Coalition Provisional Authority left Iraq, there are some extraordinary things to be had from that resolution. John Bellinger III, speaking in San Remo last year, openly bragged that he and his colleagues in the UK legal service, before the war and occupation, faced up to what international humanitarian law would not enable them to do. International humanitarian law would not enable them to rewrite the Iraq Constitution, nor would it enable them to use the proceeds of Iraqi oil on rebuilding contracts. And lastly, it wouldn't enable them to engage in preventive detention once the occupation was over. Now, if you look at Resolution 1546 and the letters that are attached to it, and if you look at what happened on the ground, you will know that the Security Council was persuaded, because it's dominated by the US and the UK, to do all of those things. I know this because I have a client who's a British national who was detained in Baghdad in October 2004, and he's still detained by UK forces in Basra, even though the intelligence on him does not support any criminal charges. And the Court of Appeal in late March said that what had happened was that Resolution 1546 had simply displaced his right not to be detained without charge. And further, every time the Security Council acts, says it's acting under Chapter 7 to maintain peace and security, the effects are the same. Therefore, if you look at how the Coalition Provisional Authority ran Iraq, bearing in mind that it was set up under Chapter 7, it was basically administering the country of Iraq from 22nd of May 2003 till the 28th of June 2004. And everything that it did, if it conflicted with the human rights of Iraqis, that resolution would have had the effect of displacing those human rights. There are many other issues about the way in which the Security Council is operating. You take that across to the UK, and it doesn't surprise us that international law and what is lawful within international law has become a highly contentious effort. We were staggered that for months before we went to war, whether or not this was going to be lawful was almost number one item on the public agenda. And 3 years later, that issue is still very prominent. So I would say that if one is thinking of how to use international law on the issue of nuclear weapons, before launching into an effort to take this back to the ICJ, which personally I would be opposed to for reasons which I can make clear if I'm asked. But I think a much better use of international law would be to try and undermine the legitimacy of countries like the UK and the US. I find it staggering, as I said this morning, that in the UK, the public have just not engaged with the issue that we are going to spend an extraordinary amount of money on something which is manifestly unlawful. I think that NGOs and lawyers have let the side down because we've not got that message through. I was reading again the challenge that Judge Weeramantry gave all of us in the legal profession in Tokyo 5 years ago when he said, the collective strength of the legal profession, particularly of the international lawyers, is much more than they might imagine, and talks about having a common discipline. That discipline speaks to them in no uncertain terms. They bear an enormous responsibility of a trust towards humanity. Well, I quite agree with that. And one of the things I'm going to talk about is our People's Tribunal. And on this tribunal, one of the four people who sat was Judge Weeramantry, because we took him seriously. Unfortunately, as an example of whether civil society is engaged in the issues of nuclear weapons or not, one only has to look at the legal profession in the UK, who, apart from literally a tiny number of exceptions, are simply not interested in nuclear weapons. They're interested in extraordinary rendition, Guantanamo Bay, preventive detention in Belmarsh, and a range of things. They are not at all interested in nuclear weapons. And I think they should be interested. And the public should be interested. And I think one way of tackling that problem is to use international law in a more creative way. If we were talking about creating a groundswell of public opinion, then we're talking about an ideological struggle. That was what was going on before and after we went to war. The government was saying over and over and over again, whatever we do will be in compliance with international law. And a number of people, in a range of different ways, set out to undermine that proposition that what they were going to do would be in compliance with international law. And one of the things that we did at Peace Rides was we held our first People's Tribunal in October 2002. We held a tribunal where we ranged a top QC against another top lawyer in front of a top professor. And the arguments on that day were all about whether one could go back to Resolution 678 at the beginning of the first Gulf War, which obviously, as you all know, became the revival doctrine, which was what it all turned on. And I believe, and I will believe this until I die, that kicking off that debate before the war had started helped. And it meant that apart from anything else, apart from getting publicity and apart from having an opportunity to air our views on national radio and in the press months before the war started, it also meant that there was a team of people, including CND and other NGOs and some leading comedians and lawyers, who were all ready with the arguments and with the network, and within 2 days of Resolution 1441 being passed, sorry, 3 days, we had decided that we were going to go to court, and that's what we did. Now, we lost for CND in that court case because the government said it was not justiciable, the principle that I was talking about this morning. But I don't think we lost a lot, actually. A lot of the public attention since the war has focused on whether or not the Attorney General could be forced to disclose his opinion. And eventually he was. Well, actually, it was leaked by Downing Street. But it didn't surprise me when I read it that he was very concerned about the threat that CND had posed. And he was warning the government that there may well be an issue of war crimes if the government went to war without a resolution, or if they conducted that war in a way that was not in compliance with international humanitarian law. The second people's inquiry that we had at Peace Rights was indeed a war crimes tribunal, where we gathered together 8 leading international law professors, and as a result of that, a formal complaint was made to the International Criminal Court prosecutor, who's still having to deal with the issue of what he's going to do about it. Now, all of that tells me that the use of people's tribunals is an idea. Clearly, his time has come. This is the idea that it's not states who have a singular control of the law, and that if state parties fail to enforce the law or do take actions that erode it, then civil society can and should step in to ensure that the state's interpretation of the law is not unchallenged. There's been, as some of you probably know, I think there was a total of 20 people's tribunals about war crimes in Iraq, which culminated in Istanbul in June 2005. And I like to think that our Peace Rights Tribunal on war crimes contributed something to that process. The third People's Tribunal is, in fact, this report here, which culminated from an inquiry which took place in November 2004. I won't bore you with the conclusions of that tribunal in great detail, although obviously it won't surprise you to know that the tribunal concluded that there was no question that the Trident nuclear weapon system could not be a proportionate use of force and therefore be outside jus ad bellum, and nor could it possibly meet the intransgressible principles of international humanitarian law, and therefore it was in breach of jus in bello as well. I won't bore you with that because that's available on our Peace Rights website if you want it. What's perhaps more important is what can we do with that report to try and engage public opinion on these issues. What we've tried to do is follow that up. A year after that report was commissioned, I instructed Rabinder Singh QC, who's a top human rights and international law QC, at Matrix, which is the chambers of the Prime Minister's wife, and also Professor Christine Chinkin. I know some of you are aware of that opinion because Professor Chinkin was invited to be at this conference. We've got plans to ensure that every MP has that opinion in front of them and is explicitly aware when they come to vote that they are voting for something which, on the advice of leading counsel and a top international law professor, is manifestly illegal. We take the view that that makes a big difference. That if something is unlawful, how can it be politically and morally acceptable? How can it be a good use of public money for us to spend so much money in the UK on something that's unlawful. So I don't have a template as to what we do to create that groundswell of public opinion. I'd like to think that some of our efforts, at least, should be focused on that ideological struggle. For my part, I think it would be a mistake, a big mistake, to spend more than a proportionate amount of our efforts in taking this matter back to the ICJ. My own view is it won't achieve anything. One of the issues I take into account is looking at the ICJ advisory opinion from 2 years ago today on the wall. After 37 years of occupation by Israel of Palestinian territories, including East Jerusalem, after innumerable General Assembly resolutions condemning Israel's continued violation of Geneva Convention 4, after Security Council resolutions, after resolutions by the US, the European Union, the high contracting parties to Geneva Convention 4, and after 11 different resolutions under the Uniting for Peace process, eventually the matter was referred to the International Court of Justice. And I don't know about you, but it took me by surprise as to the strength of that opinion. The ICJ identified 11 separate breaches of international obligations by Israel, including many which are erga omnes obligations, and then goes further and identifies 7 different obligations for other states, including some which are erga omnes, like the right to self-determination. So a very important and very strong report, which I think took many people by surprise. And then what? The Security Council have ignored that opinion. The quartet have ignored the opinion. The General Assembly appeared to be paralysed. I don't know what to do next. So I'm not sure. In my own mind, I'm not sure where that takes us. On paper, one would think that the ICJ's opinion in the occupied territories on the wall would have been a turning point. Whereas the UK government has not just continued to deal in arms, including inviting Israeli arms companies to London to an arms fair, and some of those companies engage in the manufacture of instruments of torture. But it's intensified. It's doubled in recent times the amount of export licenses that it has approved. So as far as the UK government's concerned, the ICJ may as well not have bothered. And that is another factor which I think we need to bear in mind when we are thinking about, is it really worth all the effort and the opportunity cost of what we could be doing with our time if we didn't focus on just litigating this again? For my part, I note over 10 years how convenient it is for our government to simply trot out the same mantra that their nuclear weapon programme is justified under the extreme circumstance of self-defence cop-out. So I think there's a risk that we might well make matters worse. I don't have answers to these questions. I know that no one in this room does. I'm urging caution on that, and I'm urging that whatever else we do, as Peter Weiss said, it should not be the be-all and end-all. And I think that whatever else we do, we need to do a lot to build that groundswell of public opinion. Thank you. Thank you.